Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How did light, matter, gravity, and time come into existence after the Big Bang? And how can we be sure they follow the same laws throughout the universe as they do on Earth? University of Manchester professor Brian Cox divides his professional life between researching the origins of the universe with the Large Hadron Collider and finding clever ways to make the greatest discoveries of physics comprehensible to non-scientists. In his latest effort to do just that, Cox is host of the BBC's Wonders of the Universe documentary series, which will debut tonight in the U.S. on the Discovery Science Channel. Cox is also co-author of a companion book by the same title. Brian, welcome back to Think.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be with you again.
So I'm going to maybe shock people with a statement that you make here, which is that the universe is astonishingly complex as it appears to us, and yet at its very heart, it's an incredibly simple thing. Explain what that means.
Well, over the last, 100 years, you might say, as we've been exploring the building blocks of the universe, we found that as you look back in time, so as you go back to the first few billionths of a second after the Big Bang, let's say, then the universe appears very simple then. So in particular, everything we see around us now, including ourselves, actually, is made of three subatomic particles, just three. So one called an up quark, one called a down quark, and one called an electron. We've actually discovered now that there are 12 of them as a set. But that's it. That's the building blocks of the universe. And all those things are stuck together by four forces of nature. So there's gravity, electromagnetism, which is the most familiar force, perhaps, electricity and magnetism, and then two forces that stick the atomic nucleus together called the strong and the weak nuclear forces. And that's it. And the reason that I say that it, as you go back in time, is because this simplicity reveals itself essentially as you go to higher and higher temperatures. So our picture of the universe is it began in the Big Bang, and we don't know how that happened. But we do know that it expanded and cooled and evolved. And in a sense, the complexity, things like stars and planets and people, sort of crystallized out. But they're built of very simple things. And so you mentioned the Large Hadron Collider, actually, at CERN in Geneva. Its job, or one of its jobs, is to recreate those conditions that were present, you know, less than a billionth of a second after the Big Bang. And in those conditions, you see this. You see this. These simple building blocks emerge. And it's intelligible. We can understand it, which is remarkable.
So initially, right after the Big Bang, there were just two elements in existence. Is that right? Hydrogen and helium?
Well, yeah. I mean, that's kind of a long time after the Big Bang. It's about, let's say, a minute. Between a second and a minute. So that's at the point when the universe was cold enough for the quarks, these two things that I mentioned, the up and down quarks, to come together and stick together to make protons and neutrons, which are the building blocks of atomic nuclei. So a single proton on its own is what we now call a hydrogen nucleus. So a hydrogen atom is essentially one of those with an electron going around it. And then helium is two protons and two neutrons, the next simplest element. So, yeah, so the universe was cold enough for those to crystallize out, as it were. That had stopped by around a minute.
So where did the other 90 elements that we know exist naturally in the universe come from?
That's a great question, because if you look at your hand in front of you, then obviously it's made of stuff other than hydrogen and helium. Mm-hmm. It's carbon and oxygen. It's red because there's iron in your blood. That came from generations of stars. So the process is that hydrogen and helium clump together. Probably after about half a billion years, that process started to make stars. Now, stars initially make more helium out of hydrogen. But when they've run out of hydrogen to do that in their cores, then they start cooking helium into oxygen and carbon, and they go on through all the elements up to iron, actually, in the center of their cores. So that's where all the elements up to number 26, iron, came from. It was cooked in the hearts of stars a long time ago. What then happens is that eventually the stars have cores of pretty much solid iron, which is a remarkable thing to think of, a star with a core of iron. At that point, they die. They can't release any more energy by sticking the elements together, and so they explode in what's called a supernova explosion, spread all those elements out into the universe again. So that's how the carbon and oxygen ion was released from the stars, and then those clouds of elements recombine to form solar systems like ours. So we're probably a third generation solar system, actually. So everything on the Earth has probably been through at least one or two stars. Life's, you know, they've born and they've lived and they've died before it got into the Earth and made us.
So every atom in our bodies came from a distant star somewhere.
Yeah, it's even stranger than that in a way. That's the common elements, all the ones up to iron. But of course, even in our bodies, there are heavier elements. Mm-hmm. And of course, we have jewelry made of gold and silver, platinum. Those things are heavier than iron. They only get made in the explosive deaths of stars. So a star has actually not only got to live and die, but explode to create the conditions that are violent enough to make the heaviest elements in the universe. And this is an amazing thing, actually, something that I couldn't quite believe when I was doing some research for the program. But if you look at gold, which is a precious metal because there's not very much of it, mm-hmm. there's only been about three Olympic-sized swimming pools worth of gold dug out of the ground on Earth in the entire history of the human race.
Wow.
So about three swimming pools worth of gold. The reason it's so rare is it is only made in these supernova explosions. And those, on average, in a galaxy, so the Milky Way has got about 400 billion stars like our sun in it. So on average, then, those conditions, those supernova explosions, happen about once a century. And they happen, the conditions are there for a few minutes. So basically, the conditions to make gold are that are present in a galaxy for only a few minutes every century. And that's why there's not very much of it.
Now, scientists today, Brian, know a great deal about the materials and the elements that make up different celestial objects that are almost inconceivably remote to us. And it turns out we can know these things because of the properties of light. Is that right?
Yeah, I mean, that's if you think about it, that's the only connection we've ever had with anything beyond our solar system, and possibly the only connection we'll ever have. So you look at light. Now, light carries a lot of information with it. I mean, if you look at a street light outside in the street, then sometimes they're yellow. So there's a particular kind of street light that's yellow. The reason they have a yellow light is because they've got sodium in them. So what you're actually seeing when you heat up particular elements, they emit light of particular colors. So you're looking at the composition and the structure of their atoms, actually, in the thing that's emitting the light. And you see exactly the same thing in the sun, and you see exactly the same thing in every star that we've looked at, right to the edge of the distant universe. You see the signature of the elements that are present in those objects. So it's quite remarkable that you can tell what the most distant object in the sky is made of just by looking at the properties of its light, specifically the color of its light.
Did you happen to hear the reports out this week about the giant water reservoir discovered in deep space, something like 100,000 times more massive than our sun?
I didn't, actually. We're at the edge of the solar system.
No, I think it's outside our solar system. Unfortunately, I don't have the notes with me where I discovered this, so I apologize for not being able to give you more information than that.
I mean, I do. I mean, over the last few years, actually, one of the great discoveries in the solar system has been that there's a lot more water around than we ever suspected. So we now, I think, fairly strongly believe there's water, subsurface water on Mars. We know that there was water there in the past, but we didn't know whether it had all evaporated away. Well, it looks like now there may be water below the surface. Also, Jupiter's moon Europa, which is an ice moon around Jupiter. It's a very large moon, much bigger than ours. And that's got a shell of ice. And below that, we now very strongly believe that there's an ocean of liquid water, salt water, actually. Hmm. And there's more water there than all the oceans of the Earth combined. So these are very exciting discoveries because on Earth, where there's water, there's life of one form or another. You know, so now I think now that it would be unfair to say the consensus is shifting, but I think a lot of people think we may find life on Mars if we go and look. And so there's a plan to do that. NASA and the European Space Agency have a plan to go and look for life on Mars again, and also maybe on Europa. And we also know there's a lot of water out there in comets, so these are icy objects that orbit around the sun, way beyond the orbits of the planets. And it's also just finally thought that the water, much of the water on Earth, may have been brought back to the Earth after in the early life of the solar system by comets. striking the Earth from the distant icy reaches of the solar system. So a lot of the water in our oceans now probably came from outer space.
So the way you're talking, it sounds like you're not simply saying that we know that water is necessary for life as we understand it, but it's an indicator of life.
Well, it's certainly true that I think the consensus is that you need it for life. So it's a unique substance, water, actually. It's a very strange substance in many ways. It's a perfect solvent. So it's the lubricant, if you want, for biological processes. And although you can conceive of something else, maybe liquid methane, or maybe, I think most biologists think, no, probably you need water for life. So, and it's true that on Earth, where you find water, you find life. So whereas we don't know whether if you have to see life on any object that you see liquid water present. We don't know that. And that's one of the reasons we need to go to Mars and look for it. But we do know that we're pretty sure without water, you won't find life.
And do you also need amino acids to create life?
Yeah, you need, as far as we know, you need complex carbon compounds. And they have fascinatingly been found in meteorites. So we know that there are amino acids present in space. So we know that you don't need Earth-like conditions to have that complex carbon chemistry begin. So it's possible, again, as speculative theories suggest that maybe, you know, the seeds of life were formed actually off the Earth and rained down on the Earth on the bombardment of comets and asteroids. I mean, that's speculative, but we do know there are those complex carbon compounds out there in space.
I want to talk about the physical laws that govern time and space and matter and light. How do we know that the things that happen in our part of the observable universe are in fact universal?
Well, if you look at, again, the only contact we have with the external universe is really through light. But by looking at the colors of the light, you not only see what elements are present, but you can see very, very specifically what the structure of those elements is. So very precisely how the electrons orbit around the nuclei of those elements. And those that the precise nature of that is dependent very delicately on the laws of nature. So the strengths of the forces of nature, the way the forces of nature work. So if you see the same signature in the light from distant objects, then you know that the laws of physics are the same on those objects. It's one of the most high precision tests, actually, of the laws of nature. If you just look at a hydrogen atom, the simplest thing, a proton with an electron going around it, just two particles orbiting around each other. The precise details of that, when you measure them in the laboratory, are one of the ways you can probe for new forces of nature. You can probe our understanding of the forces of nature that we know and we see on the Earth today. So it's a very precise probe, and indeed, everywhere you look in the universe, you see the same laws of physics at work.
Why does light act differently around a black hole?
Well, it doesn't really. It behaves exactly the same as anything else around a black hole. Einstein's picture of gravity is that there's not really a force of gravity. It's really the fact that space and indeed time are curved. So you could imagine looking at a valley with a black hole at the bottom of the valley. And if you imagine rolling something around the valley, then it doesn't just go in a straight line. It curves around the sides of the valley. And that's exactly the way that Einstein's theory of gravity works. So light bends around a black hole, in orbits around a black hole, essentially, in exactly the same way that a planet would go in orbit around a black hole, or indeed a star. In fact, one of the first...
I'm going to jump in for just a second.
There, so
yeah, we're going to take a quick break. My guest is particle physicist Brian Cox. He's host of the Wonders of the Universe four-part documentary series, which debuts tonight on the Discovery Science Channel. There's also a companion book by the same title. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can call us at 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a self-designed program that allows an unconventional approach to your graduate education. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
Yeah. You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour, particle physicist Brian Cox. He is host of the Wonders of the Universe four-part documentary series that will debut tonight on the Discovery Science Channel. There's also a beautiful companion book by the same title, which is written by Brian Cox and co-author Andrew Cohen. If you'd like to join the conversation, call in to 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. So, Brian, before the break, you were telling us that when sort of light is near a black hole, it circles around in the same way that if we rolled a penny around a funnel, it would sort of circle before it got to the very bottom.
Yeah, and this is one of the tests of Einstein's theory back in, not around a black hole, but light bending around a star, in fact, our star, the Sun, way back. The theory was first written down in 1915, and shortly afterwards, during a solar eclipse, so when the moon moves in front of the Sun, an expedition was sent to measure the starlight from stars just behind the Sun and to see how it curved around the Sun. And indeed, it was measured to curve around the Sun in just the same, just the way that Einstein predicted. So that was one of the first verifications of this quite strange picture of gravity, that it's not really a force. It's the, what we're seeing is the curvature of space and time.
What is the second law of thermodynamics, and why does it have such a huge influence on the workings of the universe?
Well, that's the core of one of the episodes of one of the chapters of the book, actually. And simply stated, it says that everything falls to bits. So, given time, everything tends to disorder. But there's a technical way of expressing that, and there's a concept called entropy, which is in some ways the kind of bane of a lot of undergraduate physicists' lives. Actually, it's one of the most difficult things that you teach, I think, in a physics degree, a physics course. But actually, all it really says is that the way we do it in the program is to say, if you imagine a sand castle and a pile of sand, so the same number of grains in each one, and you imagine just dropping the sand out of your hand and dropping it onto the ground, then actually the probability of it landing in a shape of a sand castle is exactly the same as it dropping in any particular pile of sand. So a very specific configuration of the grains, each one is equally likely. But of course, there are so many more ways of having a pile of sand than there are a sandcastle. That the most likely thing is that you get the sand pile, you get the disordered thing without any structure. So that can be translated into a law of thermodynamics, which is, and you can put some mathematics in, but that's essentially what it says. It just says that structured things are less likely than unstructured things. So if you just leave things alone and just let them randomly move around, in the case of the sand, the wind blows the sand around, then eventually you're going to get a featureless mass of unstructured stuff. And that turns out to be what we think the most likely fate of the universe is. So eventually, as the universe continues to expand, new star formation draws to a halt, all the stars die away, even black holes, we think, will evaporate away in a tremendously large amount of time, and you get a universe that's completely featureless and full of radiation, which is kind of sounds a bit miserable. It's called the heat death of the universe, which also sounds very miserable, but actually that's what we think the fate is. But you can rest easy, because that is it's in an astonishingly large amount of time. I should just say, actually, there's one number we quote in the program, which I think is quite remarkable, which you can calculate when the last black holes will evaporate. And it's a number, it's one with 100 noughts after it, years, 10 to the power 100 years. And I point out in the program, that how can you visualize a number like that? Well, let's say that I start counting with a single atoms. So I sit in the room now and I take an atom off the table and say one, and another atom and I say two, three. So I start counting in the years. But I'd soon run out of the atoms in the Earth, and then I'd run out of the atoms in the solar system, then I'd run out of atoms in the Milky Way galaxy. And in fact, there are not enough atoms in the observable universe to count to that number. So it's a big number. There's a lot of time left.
So the heat death of the universe is, most experts believe, the most likely fate. But I have to tell you, you present four different theories here. And the one that really got my attention was the one called the Big Bounce. Can you talk about what the idea is that it could be?
Yeah. Certainly a few years ago, we didn't know that the universe is actually accelerating in its expansion, which is a very strange concept, really. I mean, everyone thought that you have a big bang and everything flies away from everything else, and because gravity is attractive, then all the stars and galaxies attract each other and try and slow down the expansion, and they may even stop it, and then the universe could recollapse sort of a reverse direction towards another Big Bang and then bounce and then start again. So you get this kind of picture of an oscillating universe. But actually we've found out that the universe is accelerating in its expansion, and we don't know why. We really, it's one of the great mysteries in physics. It's something like 70% of the energy in the universe appears to be taken up in accelerating its expansion. So we give it a name, dark energy, which is what physicists like to do, and we don't know what it is. So it's a great bit of research. But there is still a possibility that that situation will change, but it's very speculative. And so what we know is that something like this happened before in the very, very earliest times in the universe. And this is a ridiculous time. It's a million, 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 millionths of a second after the Big Bang. And we know that one of these accelerated phases happened. Are we fairly confident it did? And that stopped. So the energy actually taken up in that is the energy we see today as matter. So the mass, the things that make up everything that we see in the universe, came from the decay of that time, that field, essentially. So you can speculate that it could happen again. So it's not completely off the table that the universe could recollapse again. But the most likely, by far, is that it just carries on accelerating and expanding forever.
So I have not yet seen the series. I have it set to record starting tonight, but I did read the book. And one of the things that I really loved, I love thinking about things that I've never considered before. You write about the evolution of eyes in creatures that exist on Earth, allowing us to perceive light that had they not evolved, we could very well have had all kinds of creatures, perhaps, but we wouldn't have been able to perceive light. What are the chances that the universe has many properties that we simply have no possible way to detect?
Oh, there's a great quote at the end of the book by one of my heroes, Carl Sagan, and he says, somewhere there's something wonderful waiting to be discovered. I think it's a beautiful thing to say. And so it's clearly true. We're discovering planets around virtually every star that we look at now. We've discovered well over 500. I think it's close to 1,000 planets around distant stars. Some that appear to be Earth-like, some that are like Jupiter. You know, some have solid surfaces. So you cannot begin to conceive of the diversity that's out there waiting for us. It's really waiting for us to go and look at it. So I think there's certainly, if you're talking about phenomena like life and beautiful planetary surfaces, there's bound to be those places out there. And whether, you know, the thing is, though, that remarkably, I think the underlying laws that govern the way that everything works, we could be close to knowing those. We have a very good idea of the laws that stick together pretty much everything that we can see and we've observed. So, and actually, you mentioned the Large Hadron Collider. I mean, that's looking for some of the missing pieces in that picture of the universe now and getting close to finding them, I think.
My guest is Brian Cox. You can join our conversation by sending email to think@kera.org, or you can call into 1-800-933-5372. We have a question here from Cal, who writes, a report on NPR a few days ago said some evidence for the Higgs particle had been detected at the Large Hadron Collider.
Yeah, that's right. We know that the Higgs, I should say, it's a theory. It's a theoretical mechanism that generates mass in the universe. So to put simply, if you're sat in front of a table now and you thump it with your hand, it's obviously solid. The wood there has got mass. Your hand has got mass. Well, I find it quite remarkable, actually, that years ago, back in the 1960s, for mathematical reasons, this rather esoteric theory was introduced that mass comes from the interaction of all these particles that around us with something else called the Higgs field. And it sounds, it's like, why would you do that? And it really was quite esoteric. And it's just, it's mathematically nice, but conceptually it may seem a little odd. I mean, why would you go to that level of complexity? But actually, over the years, this thing has survived all attempts to show it to be nonsense, right? Just survive. Although we haven't seen the Higgs field yet. We haven't seen these things called Higgs particles. Well, now, for the first time, there is evidence that they're there. And it looks to be. So we've seen hints of a new particle that looks to have the properties that we would expect of a Higgs particle. And the reason everyone's cautious is because, statistically speaking, it's not yet a discovery. There's a very, very clear definition of what a discovery is in physics, in particle physics, and we're not there yet. So we've got to take more data. But if this is there, then we would expect to have that data within 6 months or so. So you would think, with a bit of luck by the end of the year, if not, then at some point next year, if this signal stays there, then it's the Higgs. So it's the first time that there's a really credible hint of the Higgs particle.
What changes if we find that it in fact exists?
Well, it's the missing piece of the jigsaw in our understanding of three of the four forces of nature. So everything other than gravity, our understanding of everything else, sits in something called the Standard Model of Particle Physics. And the Higgs is an integral part of that. And it has been, as I said, for many decades. So it was always required to make that work. And if it was not right, it could still not be right, but so if it's not right, then there's something we really don't understand about the universe. But I think it's going to be, if it turns out to be there, I think it's going to be one of the great discoveries in the history of science. Because I mean, if you think about it, we're talking about a fundamental property of the universe, you know, the existence of this all-permeating field that leads to mass, this fundamental property of substance. And we derived it. You know, we someone wrote it down with a pencil and a piece of paper. and the fact, to me, is it never ceases to amaze me that we can be, we may be so clever that that's actually it, and we've discovered it with this huge machine in Geneva, which was really built to search for it. 16 miles in circumference, tens of thousands of physicists from 85 countries around the world looking for something that a man who's still alive, Peter Higgs, who's still there in Edinburgh, wrote down in the 1960s with a pencil. I think it's amazing.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go to Veronica on the phone in Fort Worth. Hi, Veronica.
Hello. I had a question. I saw a show on the Science Channel about some physicists at some building called the Parameter, and I think that's what it's called. And they were talking about pre-Big Bang. I guess it must be like the balance type deal. And I guess before Big Bang, like how they're saying, well, it wasn't just nothing. There was something.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it's called the Perimeter Institute, I think, in Canada. And it's probably, there's a friend of mine actually called Neil Turok, who's a cosmologist who works on models in which the universe has been around forever. And you might say, well, how can that be? Because we've got this very strong evidence that there was a Big Bang. But what these things look like is that you visualize it, there are extra dimensions in the universe. So the best way to visualize it, I think, is to imagine there's a sheet of paper in the room in front of you, and imagine that we live on that sheet. We're not allowed to move anywhere else. So we're just squashing our universe down into two dimensions so we can imagine it, just sat on a sheet of paper. So light, for example, has to travel on the sheet. So you couldn't see anything that was out in the wider room because light's only allowed to travel on the sheet. So that could be what the universe looks like. And so really, we could be living on this sheet in a higher dimensional universe. And what can happen is there can be many of those things, and they can bump into each other. And what Neil and his colleagues calculated is, what does it look like when they bump into each other? Well, they get very hot and very dense, and they separate away, and then they stretch and they cool down, and it's exactly what you see as a Big Bang. So if you were on the sheet, you would see that collision. All the things you see would look like the universe beginning at a Big Bang, when actually what you're seeing is a collision of two of these sheets. So it's speculative stuff, but what you have to remember at the Big Bang is what we know is that as you run time backwards, so you wind the clock back in our universe, then the universe gets denser and denser and denser and hotter and hotter and hotter. All the galaxies come together, and it looks like there was a time when it was very hot and very dense, and it's expanded and cooled ever since. So you're allowed to put theories together that fit that data, and that's one of the theories that fits the data, but it's very speculative.
Is it possible to experience time in any direction other than the direction that we know it to go in from past to future without sort of leaving where we are right now?
No is the almost certainly correct answer. So there are caveats there. We have to go forward in time. As the laws of physics, some of the laws of physics forbid going backwards in time.
Mm-hmm.
So Einstein's theory of relativity, from which you get E equals MC squared, forbids it. Einstein's theory of gravity almost forbids it, but there are some possible loopholes, but many people think those will be closed. So it looks like the universe is built such that you have to go forward in time, but you can go forward in time at any speed that you want relative to somebody else. So, and what really happens, and this is really true, is that if someone flies along past your window now at 100 miles an hour, then their clock, their time, literally their time, is running slower than yours from your perspective. So you look at their clock and you would see their clock running slowly. And you might say, well, that is so they got into the future more slowly. And you might think, well, this is nonsense. And it was predicted by Einstein, again, with a pencil, basically. He worked this out. But actually the GPS, satellite navigation system, works on this principle. There are satellites flying around. They're in high orbit. They're moving fast relative to the surface of the Earth. And if you didn't correct for the fact that time runs at a different rate, then the system would drift by over 30,000 feet a day in positional accuracy. So you think about that, it just wouldn't work. So time does pass at a different rate for the satellites, and it has to be corrected. So it's engineering. It's not physics now, it's engineering.
We'll take a call right now, and maybe you can give the answer after we take our break. Hi, Richard in Garland. How you doing?
I'm doing good. I had a question. First, I wanted to say I'm a huge fan of all the programs I've seen Ryan on, and huge fan of Carl Sagan as well. My question's pretty humble. I just wanted to know why it is that light and other small particles travel in waves rather than just move in a straight line, because I start to think about just like Newtonian physics, and it should just travel in a straight path unless acted upon something. Certainly something is making it oscillate like that, but what is it that makes these small particles travel in these waves rather than just a simple straight line?
Great question, Richard. We will get an answer for you from Brian after the break. My guest this hour is particle physicist Brian Cox. He is host of the series Wonders of the Universe. It's a four-part documentary series that debuts tonight on the Discovery Science Channel. There's also a companion book by the same title. We'll return to our conversation with Brian after this break. If you would like to join it, you can call in to 1-800-933-5372 or drop an email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a self-designed graduate program that allows you the chance to meet the challenges of society. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is physicist Brian Cox. He's a professor at the University of Manchester and host of Wonders of the Universe, the four-part series debuting on the Discovery Science Channel tonight. There's also a companion book by the same title. We had, Brian, before the break, a call from Richard who wanted to know why light travels in waves.
Yeah, it's a great question. I mean, it's a question essentially about this quantum theory. Now, quantum theory has a reputation for being esoteric and odd, but actually it is our theory of everything other than gravity. So gravity is the only thing that sits outside that framework. So actually the question is more, the actual question is, why do big things move in this, I think the caller used this idea, that a Newtonian way? In other words, if you throw a baseball through the air, then you know what path it's going to take. It's called a parabola. Mm-hmm. You know how it's going to curve. But actually, it turns out that emerges from a deeper theory called quantum theory. Quantum theory is rather more democratic than that, actually. It's rather simpler in its aims initially. You ask the question, let me put a particle, a subatomic particle, in the room now and put it in front of me. Where's it going to be at the next instant of time? And the answer is, quite literally, it can be anywhere in the universe, which is a very odd thing to say. It sounds ridiculous, right? But actually, that's what you start from in quantum theory. And what the theory does is it just kind of hacks away at that freedom that things have to move around. And you're left with the real world that emerges, but you're still left with some of this rather more democratic behavior, that things can behave as though they're spread out, or certainly they behave as though they can travel many paths around the world at the same time. And that's where this emergent property comes from. So that's where the wave nature of light comes from. And particles also behave as waves in certain circumstances, in atoms, for example. So that's why atoms are stable. That's how electrons orbit around the nuclei in atoms. So it's kind of, I know it's kind of difficult to picture, but actually the lesson is that the subatomic world behaves in a way that's very predictable, and we know the rules by which it works, but it's not quite the way you might expect. But we do know how the big world, to a large extent, we know how the big world emerges from that picture. And I'll say just gratuitously to finish this, although I don't want to plug other books that I'm working on, but I am working on a book on quantum mechanics, which follows exactly this line of reasoning. And it'll be out before Christmas, actually. So maybe I'll be back on the show promoting that book before Christmas.
That would be lovely.
Yeah.
Is light the only thing we know of that behaves as both a particle and a wave?
No, all subatomic particles behave in exactly the same way, which is as in this, I suppose, not quite like a particle and not quite like a wave, but like a quantum particle. They're all quantum particles. They all obey the same rules. So electrons behave in exactly the same way as particles of light, which we call photons. So it's kind of historic in a way that we see the wave-like nature of light, of these things. From the 1900, the seeds of this were sown, but it emerged that actually a theory that light is a stream of particles called photons was really forced upon us throughout the 20th century. Einstein never liked it, actually, particularly, and he was one of the originators of it. But there it is. And the other particles behave like that as well. So a great example is an electron, the particle of electricity. Well, the only way you can understand how it works in an atom is to treat it as a wave-like object.
Let's go back to the phones now at 1-800-933-5372. This time we will speak with James in Plano. Hi, James.
Hi, how you doing?
Great, thanks.
Great program. I think, this study of physics and the universe is just fascinating and one of the greatest endeavors of man. I was listening to this and kind of threw three things that were said together and came up with a question. Early on, you were talking about the moment before the Big Bang, when things were so cold, and I guess two up and down quarks joined together, and then there was this tremendous explosion of heat and radiation. And then recently you were talking about eventually things cool down and there'll be a heat death in the universe. Yeah. And so the question is, and this is layman speculative, but is it possible that there has been many creations and deaths of universes and there will be many more to come, or do you think maybe that there's just one universe that goes on forever? And I'll listen to the answer off the air.
Thanks for your call.
Brilliant question. The correct answer is we don't know. There are theories where there can be new universes emerging all the time, essentially. And there are theories in which there's only one universe, and this is it. It's absolutely correct to say that we don't know. If you ask the question why did the universe begin? Right? What was it that triggered the beginning of the universe? We have absolutely no idea. We talked about one speculative idea that, in fact, the universe had been around forever, and then you wouldn't have to deal with the difficult issue of what started it. So that's quite nice. But we genuinely don't know, and there are speculative theories. So your scenario could be correct.
Do you have a favorite? Do you like the idea of multiple universes?
I don't know. I think that the science, to me, is quite simple. What you're trying to do is explain things that you see. So it's a very simple process. So what we see is we see an expanding universe, and we've been able to explain that very beautifully with a theory that's simple, that just says that it began and it's been expanded and cooling down ever since. And that's what the evidence tells you, and there's lots of evidence for that. So unless you have a particular thing that you don't understand, then speculation is kind of fun, but I don't know whether there's an idea called Occam's razor, which is that in science where you just go for the simplest thing until someone tells you different, right, until you find something that doesn't agree with the simplest thing. So I suppose the simplest thing is there's one universe. It began 13.7 billion years ago, and we'll investigate that one. But there are big questions about how it began, though, so that's where you get the speculation.
We have an email here from Ishita who wants to know, how do we tackle the nature of dimensionality before the Big Bang? Where did it happen if all of the universe began there?
Well, there we go again. I mean, the standard picture is that space and time began at that point. So if you think about that, if you say time began at that point, then you're not even allowed to ask what happened before because there wasn't any time, which sounds like with the current kind of issues in the United States, sounds like a congressman's answer, that, right? It sounds like a political dodge to some extent, but it isn't. That's Einstein's picture of the universe. It's space and time began at that point. So, again, you know, if you think that's unsatisfactory, then you're not alone. It's not an explanation of how the universe began. We just don't have one.
Did this stuff all, I mean, I'm sure not all of it came easily to you, but were these concepts always easy for you to accept into your mind even before you could understand them? Or has it been a process over the years that you've worked as a physicist?
No, I think it's a process, but it's quite an easy one. I really, when I go into schools and when I talk to people, I always want to emphasize that there's no such, you don't need to be a genius. You don't need to be unusually clever or anything like that to be a scientist. And it's really important, actually, for kids to know that, because we need more scientists and engineers. And if you think that you need to be Einstein in order to make progress, then no one's going to do it. But you don't. So the thing is, you learn a very simple lesson, which is that science is a framework, really. That's all it is. It's a process that allows you to sort of understand what you found out, understand the evidence that you see in front of you, and make sense of it. And so you have to go with that process. You have to trust it. You have to, if it says that particles behave like waves and waves behave like particles, and that's what the evidence says, then you don't have to get confused about it. I mean, what you can say is, okay, well, that's how they behave then. And so in a way, I think if you get rather too philosophical about science, although it's fun, I think it sometimes leads to confusion. I mean, the way the world behaves like the world behaves, and if you don't like it, then that's, you know, it's quite easy. It's easy to just say, well, that's the best theory that we have at the moment, so I'll go with that. I'm not going to ask too many questions about it. I'm happy with it.
Let's go back to the phones now, 1-800-933-5372. We'll speak with Peter in Euless. Hi, Peter.
Hi. My question for your guest is, it's actually a concern. I was reading in the newspaper yesterday that scientists are very near, close to discovering the God particle from the Hadron Collider experiment in Europe.
This is the Higgs again.
Is that a reality? And if that is the case, what theological questions will that raise? And the other part of my question, if the God particle is discovered, is it likely that there is intelligent life elsewhere in the universe?
No, it's the God particle is an utterly misleading and terrible term for the Higgs particle, the Higgs particle is, it got named that in a book, and it just stuck because it's a catchy title. So it's probably some publisher just decided it was a good idea, right? But it's got no implication beyond the fact that it's the mechanism that we think generates mass in the universe. So it's got nothing to do with anything else. It's just, an unfortunate title. The use of the word God, by the way, has caused lots of misunderstandings in physics. It was often used by Einstein, and Einstein used it. You've got to remember, it's a different age then. There was no controversy around religion and science coexisted perfectly well. There was no friction, and there should be no friction between them. And Einstein often used it as a shorthand for the laws of nature. And that was fine. It was kind of understood in that way, really. So I think that it's a very, very unfortunate term because we live in an age where there's some confusion about the interface between religion and science that, by the way, I don't think should be there. I think that it's a very destructive thing. So, God particle, doesn't matter. Silly name. Nothing to do with God at all.
So, Brian, tell us a little bit about the four different parts of the series. I gather they run weekly. Is that right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, there are four episodes. They run Wednesdays at 9 on Science Channel. The first one is about we've talked about it quite some length, the origin of the elements, so where the chemical elements came from, and also the life cycle of stars. Then there's a program about light, as you said. There's one about gravity, and there's one about essentially what I'd call thermodynamics, but we don't call it that. So it's the origin, evolution, and fate of the universe.
You don't want to scare people away with the term thermodynamics, is that?
No, we don't want to say that. I probably say it in the film because I like saying the correct technical terms, but yeah, we frame it in a different way. So they were designed to do two things. One is tell the story of the universe, talk about the history of the universe, but also tell the story of four fundamental ideas in physics. So it says thermodynamics, origin of the elements, gravity, and light.
Was everything easy for you to find a sort of practical illustration that people could relate to?
No, it was very difficult. Mm-hmm. We made a previous series called Wonders of the Solar System, mm-hmm. which is also on Science Channel and the BBC, and that was easy because we're talking about volcanoes on one of Jupiter's moons, then you go to a volcano on Earth and
yeah.
talk about it. The thing is, though, when you're talking about thermodynamics or gravity, what do you do? And so we worked hard to find locations on Earth that could act as a backdrop and add something to the explanations. For example, in the story about things falling to bits of the universe tending to disorder, we found a spectacular gold diamond mining town in Namibia, mm-hmm. in southern Africa, which had been abandoned and had decayed back into the desert for 50 years. So all the buildings are falling down. It's been reclaimed by the sand and the desert winds. And that was a beautiful backdrop because it speaks sort of emotionally about the story that you're telling. You don't need to refer to it, really. It's there as a kind of an idea reinforcing the idea of the physics.
Are there certain concepts that are easier to explain in something like a book and others that you'd rather do on video?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, that's why I think the book works well as a companion, because it can dig deeper mm-hmm. into particular concepts. But again, one of the reasons you do a television documentary about science, it's impressionistic in some ways. I mean, what it's designed to do is excite the viewer about the concepts. You know, give as much information as you can, but it's really to capture the imagination and then hopefully inspire them to dig deeper. And then you can start digging deeper with the book. But obviously, there's a huge amount of literature on all these concepts. So what I hope is that you watch the program, it's an emotional impact as well as an intellectual impact in a way. It's a film. It's a piece of entertainment. But it hopefully will grab your interest and send you on a deeper journey.
In the last few seconds, what's all this about the BBC lowering the volume on the music that you had selected for the film?
it was a bizarre, believe it or not, there are some elements of the press in Britain that like to have a go at the BBC occasionally. And there were a few complaints. The BBC said they were going to lower the music. There were many more complaints about that. And in the end, we turned it back up again. But don't worry, in the US, you have the full musical splendor.
We like it loud in this country. Brian
yeah.
Cox is host of the BBC's Wonders of the Universe series. There is also a companion book. The series debuts tonight on the Discovery Science Channel. Brian, it's always a pleasure. And when you have that new book out, please give us a call. We'd love to have you back.
I will do. It's always a pleasure. Thank you.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.
The Think production team includes engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.